Well, here we go. The final weekend of the 2018 primary campaign in both Kansas and Missouri is upon us. There will be lots of last-minute campaigning, lots of last-minute flyers in your mailboxes, lots of TV commercials flickering across your screens. This morning, we'll get down to the major races on both sides of the state line to get you ready to walk into the voting booth with confidence next week. With us, Colleen Nelson is a Kansas City Star Vice President and editor of the editorial page. Colleen, nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Manis is a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joe, good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Stephanie Sharp is owner of the Johnson County-based Sharp Connections political firm. She's a former Republican state lawmaker, and she joins us via Skype. Stephanie, welcome to you.
Good morning.
You know, Colleen, primaries are taking place in both Kansas and Missouri on Tuesday, but it seems to me that most of the action here is on the Kansas side of the state line. Does that go without saying?
That goes without saying. There are more competitive races in Kansas, at least in the primaries. I think we'll have a lot of action in Missouri heading into the general. But on the Kansas side, you have a competitive race both for the Republicans in the governor's race and the Democrats in the governor's race. You have a six-candidate free-for-all in the Democratic primary in the 3rd Congressional District of six really strong candidates trying to face off with Kevin Yoder in the general election. The 2nd Congressional District has primaries as well. So voters actually have choices to make on Tuesday in Kansas.
Joe Manis, what's the hottest race or issue on the Missouri side of the state line?
Well, I think it goes without saying on our side of the state, it's mainly Prop A, which is the statewide ballot proposal over the right to work law that was passed about a year and a half ago that labor has forced a referendum on the St. Louis area anyway. The no on Prop A signs are everywhere. And it's not just this contest that it affects, because our big election for the new St. Louis County executive is also on the ballot between incumbent Steve Stenger and businessman Mark Montavani. It's a really nasty, very expensive Democratic race. But many people, including me, think that it could be affected by what happens with Prop A. Huh. Because Stenger in particular, all of his ads begin with him saying he's against Prop A, he's with labor. Montavani actually has had some talks with labor groups to emphasize that he's against it too, although Stenger claims he's not. So my point is that those two issues, that contest and the ballot proposal, have become sort of married over here.
Stephanie Sharp, if you had to pick one, what's the hottest race on the Kansas side?
My passion is state and local races, so you know, I'm looking at the state legislative races. There are obviously a couple of statewide races that are critically important. The governor's race probably has the most long-lasting and most immediate impact on the state legislative races as well. So I would say the governor's race is probably the hottest.
Right.
Hottest ticket on the ballot this week.
You know, Stephanie, I've been struck, particularly on the Kansas side, by how civilized these races have been for the most part. And I wrote as much in a column today. How surprising is that, given, again, how close the races for governor seem to be and the race that Colleen mentioned, which is that 3rd District congressional race on the Democratic side, on the Kansas side as well?
Sure. I think that when you think of civil, you think of it's not being nasty on the airwaves. It's certainly been nasty on social media, where it's mostly free. And I think that what you see, this lack of angst at the macro level, is because there are so many candidates in so many races. You've got, like you said, six people on the Democrat side for Congress. You've got three on the Republican side. You've got how many plus the teenagers running for governor on both sides, Republican and Democrat. I think that there are so many candidates that there's not enough money that any one person has enough to really go up on air for as long as they needed to, and for just to start making those nicks in the polls. I think that's what, it's not necessarily that it's civil, it's that it's quiet because there's nobody has enough money to make it be uncivil. That makes sense.
Yeah. Joe Manis, I wanted to visit with you for a few minutes about a couple of Missouri races before you go. Let's begin with the U.S. Senate race. How safe is it to assume that Claire McCaskill and Josh Hawley are going to emerge as their party's nominees on Tuesday?
Pretty safe.
Yeah.
Pretty safe. I think what they're going to do is that they're going to be vying over who has the higher percentage of the Democratic vote versus the Republican vote, who saw a bigger turnout, that sort of thing, which is all kind of posturing in a primary. Both of them have a whole bunch of people running against them, but nobody knows them. They haven't been campaigning. It's pretty much, I mean, in the Republican side, there's been a couple who are on, who have been doing some campaigning, but the bottom line is Hawley's expected to win comfortably on Tuesday, and the same with McCaskill. Now, there's a couple congressional contests on our side of the state where it's a little more up in the air, but right. Those two, I think it's pretty guaranteed.
Colleen Elson, you know, this Hawley-McCaskill matchup, at least according to some national pundits, is going to rank as the premier Senate race in the entire country. Why is that? And what does that mean for Missourians who are going to be besieged with TV ads come fall?
Right. Well, in part, it's a premier race because Republicans see it as a great target for them. And I mean, Republicans are fighting like heck to hang on to the Senate. And so this is a chance for them to pick up a seat. Claire McCaskill arguably could have, should have lost in her last race, but she faced such a weak Republican opponent in Todd Akin that she managed to prevail. And since then, Missouri has become even a redder state. So McCaskill's a Democratic senator trying to win in a state that Trump carried by 19 points.
Right.
And so Republicans are willing to put all of their money, all of their resources, everything they've got into picking up this seat. And Democrats sure don't want to lose it. So they will do the same to help Claire McCaskill.
You know, between PACs and the candidate spending, we're looking literally at tens of millions of dollars here, right?
Right. This could be the most expensive race that Missouri's ever seen by far. And so I think Missouri voters are going to be exhausted by November
yeah.
because we're going to see so much on the airwaves. We're already seeing some pretty nasty ads from outside groups taking aim at both of these candidates. And it's not clear always where the money is coming from, who's behind these different ads. And this is going to be ugly. You talk about it being civil on the Kansas side. This is not going to be civil.
You know, Joe, one thing that has struck me about the Senate race so far, even though we're in the primary campaign phase of it, the back and forth between the candidates and the email traffic coming to reporters has been at mid-October levels. At least that's how it strikes me. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think so, too. In fact, when you talked about all the ads in the fall, I'm like, no, all the ads are already here by these outside groups, at least on the St. Louis airways. You see a lot of them. And they're already battling over particular issues. I've already written stories, like, within the last 6 weeks, you know, on the pre-existing conditions fight, the abortion fight, the fight over the Supreme Court justice nominee, the tariffs. I mean, so a lot of stuff that you would expect to hear maybe a month or two down the road, they're already out there. And that's aside from the personal attacks, you know, whether or not he buys wine during business hours and her husband's nasty divorce 20 years ago. I mean, you know, there's stuff that like that that's coming up already. In fact, this it reminds me a little bit, but actually on steroids, of the Roy Blunt, Robin Carnahan contest in 2010, from the standpoint that during that summer and early fall, all these national outside groups came in and just pummeled her, and she wasn't even ready for it. I mean, she ended up losing by 14 points and actually setting the stage for Democrats below her to lose. But the point was there was a lot of outside traffic, and she wasn't able to stand up to it. Now, with McCaskill, it could be different. I mean, Jason Kander, the Democratic nominee for the Senate just 2 years ago, he did lose, but only by 3 points to Roy Blunt, an incumbent. I mean, if Donald Trump had not been such a huge wave in Missouri, I think Kander would have won that
right.
seat. So I think to say that Missouri is redder, I'm not sure if I agree with that. I think it depends on the race.
So, Colleen, if people are wondering why the U.S. Senate race is already at such a high pitch, Is this a fight over first impressions, or why are candidates spending so much time and energy and money in June and July when the vote is in November? What's that about?
Now, that's a great question. I mean, I think one easy answer is that the primaries haven't been super competitive in this race. I mean, Josh Hawley is running against some other Republicans, but pretty quickly the Republican Party basically declared this a fait accompli and put their resources behind Josh Hawley. Donald Trump has come out and endorsed Josh Hawley, has already campaigned with Josh Hawley, and so he kind of skipped past the primary and turned his focus to Claire McCaskill. And Claire McCaskill doesn't have anyone who's actively campaigning in any meaningful way against her, and so she just started immediately turning her guns on Josh Hawley. And I mean, this is going to be a competitive race, so there was no time to waste, and so they both jumped in with both feet, got started making their best arguments, and so I mean, the question is, how tired are voters going to be by the end of this when this geared up so early?
And the answer is, they're already tired right now. You know, Joe, if you do have to look ahead to the fall campaign between Hawley and McCaskill, you've already mentioned some issues we're going to be hearing a lot about: the U.S. Supreme Court, abortion rights, and or not. What else?
Healthcare,
I mean, right.
Yeah, I mean, McCaskill is at every stop that I've been to on this side of the state, and she's been here a lot lately because she lives in Kirkwood. It headlines healthcare. And she, in fact, at the Truman dinner about 6 weeks ago, which is the statewide Democratic dinner, she asked everybody to stand up who had a pre-existing condition or a relative, and almost the whole room stood up. This is like about 500-600 people. And I took a picture of that, put it on Twitter just for the heck of it. I have never had a tweet retweeted like that. I mean, I'm talking over 3,000 retweets. It was crazy. And I think it's because, for whatever reason, Democrats in particular are focusing on healthcare nationally, but she's really driving it here in Missouri. Every event she has, she starts talking about that. So I think that she sees that as an opening. I think Hawley, while he says that he agrees with her on some things but says the Senate's not doing its job, he might need to sharpen his message, because she is sort of pummeling him on that. At the same time, he's getting her on the whole Supreme Court nominee business. So I think you're going to be hearing all this for several months, and if the Senate finally has hearings on Kavanaugh this fall, that could heighten stuff up further. So I think this is what's intriguing to me. I think this is going to get personal, but I really think there's going to be a lot of issues people are focusing on this time rather than just, the basics that you normally hear about somebody's personality or how much federal money their family has collected for this and that. I think you're going to see a lot about issues, more than I've seen in a while.
Let's move on to Prop A. This is the right to work ballot initiative on the Missouri ballot. I just want to kiss it quickly. Colleen, a vote for Prop A does what, and what does a no vote on Prop A do, just so voters might be prepared as they walk in the polls here?
Right. So it's not necessarily intuitive. And
yes,
the legislature passed a right to work law. And so if you vote yes on Prop A, you're affirming that you want this right to work law, which basically says that workers in certain union shops have the option of basically opting out of the union entirely. And right now they can opt out of full union membership, but in some places they can still be required to pay some union fees for collective bargaining and just being represented by the union. And so if you vote no, you're saying you want to repeal the right to work law. And so it's not exactly logical,
yes,
or intuitive which way you should vote. So you kind of have to think through exactly which way that goes.
And the law that the Missouri General Assembly passed and then Governor Greitens signed was frozen while this ballot initiative played out in Missouri.
Right. And so we've seen a lot of energy around this question. And
yes,
I mean, at this point, if you're basing it on yard signs, I mean, the vote no folks have a lot of manpower. I mean, the unions see this as a significant threat to them. And they say that if you allow this right to work law to stand, that it will depress wages. They certainly see it as hastening the decline of unions as well.
Okay, we're going to flip back to the Kansas side. And in the meantime, I want to thank Joe Manis from St. Louis Public Radio for giving us a little preview on the Missouri side. Joe, I sure appreciate it.
Hey, well, thanks for having me, Steve. Thanks.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're offering you a little election preview in this segment of the program. We're with Colleen Nelson from the Kansas City Star, Stephanie Sharp, owner of the Johnson County-based Sharp Connections political firm. Let's go over and talk about Kansas governor here, and we'll start with the Republicans here, Stephanie. Four candidates are in the race: Governor Jeff Collier, Secretary of State Chris Kobach, former State Senator Jim Barnett, and Insurance Commissioner Ken Selzer. Stephanie, is there any reason to think this is anything other than a two-horse race between Collier and Kobach?
I would agree with that. I think that the other two, Selzer and Barnett, are both good candidates, good qualified candidates. Obviously, Senator Barnett was the nominee in 2006.
How fast the time goes by, Stephanie.
Right? Time flies when you're having fun.
Yes.
But if you also remember, Senator Susan Weigel out of Wichita was his running mate at the time, who has most recently endorsed Secretary of State Kobach for the governorship. So it's a real interesting dynamic there. But I do think that Collier and Kobach are the two at the very top. Kobach is certainly the man to beat in a primary. As we were talking about primaries in the different states, you know, Kansas has been a Republican state all but twice in our history has the state house ever switched to Democrat. So our races happen in the primary. This is our election. 80% of our elected officials are done in the primary. So.
Right.
This is it is a conservative in both cases. In any state you go to, it is always the extremes that vote in the primaries. So what we're trying to do is encourage the 80% of us that sit somewhere in that middle to vote in these primaries and get engaged, because Kobach obviously starts out, because extremes vote in the primaries, Kobach starts out with a solid 30%. So in my view, he is the person to beat in this race.
You know, and Colleen, speaking of moderates and outliers in this four main candidate Kansas primary election for governor on the Republican side, Jim Barnett does sort of stick out in a way. He's the more moderate candidate. How do you look at him?
He's the only person who stands out, because I think when this race started, the expectation was that Kobach would be a little bit of the outlier, that he would be to the farthest to the right, and everyone else would kind of have to find a lane. But as the campaign has continued, Selzer and Collier and Kobach have all started to sound more and more alike. And when you listen to their debates, it's really hard to find differences among those three. And so Barnett is the only one who's carved out a different lane and basically said, I'm an unabashed moderate. I think that what Sam Brownback did to Kansas is wrong. We need to reinvest in the state, and I'm willing to lay out some positions that diverge from Republican orthodoxy and go against Chris Kobach, go against Donald Trump. And so, I mean, Barnett is an outlier in this race, and it's an interesting test of where the Republican Party is in Kansas.
You know, Stephanie, if a voter had to choose between Kobach and Collier here, again, the two front runners, or at least you hear about them in that way the most, how would they do it? What are the distinctions there?
Well, I think that there's a good point in what Colleen mentioned is, you know, are you going to vote on ideology or on, and there are a lot of people in this state who want to know, okay, who can beat Chris Kobach? Because my concern, and I will say I do not want Chris Kobach getting into the general election. It is disastrous folly to think that he would be the easier candidate to beat. I think if that happens, every hate group from across the country, possibly the world, comes into Kansas and invests heavily in that election. Hmm. And I don't know that he would have to spend a dime of Wink Hartman's money to do really well in that general election. It's very concerning. So
Wink Hartman being Chris Kobach's running mate, who's got
correct.
Money to spend, right?
Who's mm-hmm. already loaned $1.5 million to the campaign. So. You know, do you vote on ideology or do you vote on who more of a against someone else? Who can beat Chris Kobach? And in that way, I do think that Collier is the only one who can beat Chris Kobach. And I full disclosure, Selzer, Barnett, and Collier have all purchased ads from me from the Shawnee Mission Post. So I have to put that disclaimer out there. I am business affiliated with all three of those campaigns. So, but I will say, just numbers wise, I spent a lot of my, actually, it's interesting. I worked for Sam Brownback a long time ago, and then spent the last number of years helping candidates run against the things that he did to our state. And so I am by no means a cheerleader for Governor Collier. I do think that he has improved the tone. There's been a huge improvement in the tone with the legislature, the tone inside the Capitol, as well as the quality of cabinet officials. Mm-hmm. He has made significant change there. But I would rather see, I think it would be a better conversation to have Collier in the general election with whatever Democrat comes out of that general election or out of their primary. It's going to be a better conversation for Kansas.
I want to get to the Democrats for governor, the Democrats for the 3rd District of Kansas, the congressional seat, just quickly here. We talk about Democrats for governor, Colleen. The main candidates there are Josh Swatty, Carl Brewer, Laura Kelly. Again, a surprisingly civil contest, relatively speaking, but guns and abortion have played a big role in this race. How so?
Right. So you have three candidates who agree on a lot of issues. And so guns and abortion are two of the rare issues where you see a little bit of daylight between Swatty and Laura Kelly. And so Josh Swatty was a legislator from a conservative district, and he voted for a lot of pro-life positions. He voted for abortion restrictions, diverged from the Democratic Party as a legislator, and so he's gotten a lot of pressure from the Democratic Party to say, that's not going to fly with our party. What would you do as governor? And he now says that as governor, he would not sign any additional abortion restrictions.
And Laura Kelly has it on guns.
Exactly.
Some issues there,
right.
Which is what?
So she's cast some controversial for a Democrat votes on guns to support concealed carry and allow more gun rights. And so she has subsequently said that she regrets some of those votes and kind of walked that back. So they've both kind of hedged on their previous positions on this and said, I'm a real Democrat.
Let's go to the 3rd District congressional primary again on the Democratic side. Stephanie, this is for the seat that represents Johnson and Wyandotte counties. Again, six candidates. It's already been said they're all in it for the right reasons. There's not a weak candidate among them. And yet, it's an intensely competitive race. What's going on out there that's causing these candidates to behave so well, Stephanie?
Well, you know, I actually would disagree that they're strong candidates. I don't know that there's a single one of them that, if they beat Kevin, could hold on to that seat. I think one of the front runners is a teacher, but he teaches at Pembroke on the Missouri side.
This is Tom Nierman,
Correct. Two of the people that get the most attention, Sharice Davids and Welder, neither of them have lived in the state for more than a year. Or actually, at this point, I think it's actually been right at a year. So how they can, you know, come and say that they have the voice of the people, I don't know how that works. So I don't know that any of those candidates are particularly strong. And again, I think it's that there's so many of them that none of them have enough money to really make it an impact. And it really plays in well with what you all were just talking about the Missouri side. There's so much money over there, and so much of it is being spent in the Kansas City metro that it's really difficult to make waves if you're a congressional candidate without much money on the Kansas side. I do think that in the Wichita areas, in the Topeka network, in the Salina area, they're probably more you'll probably hear more commercials and hear more radio from the gubernatorial candidates out there. But here it's just too hard. It's too spread out.
Right. How would you distinguish these candidates from one another, Colleen? Is there a way to do it, or is it, I think I've referred to it as picking your favorite flavor of lollipop here at some point.
Exactly. It's a steep challenge for voters, particularly since none of these folks has held elected office before. They all admit that they agree on most issues. I mean, I think Brent Welder has kind of separated himself a little bit, for better or for worse, by virtue of having Bernie Sanders' endorsement and kind of embracing Bernie Sanders' platform of, you know, Medicare for all, free college for all. But I'm not sure that the 3rd District, how well that will play. I mean, is the 3rd District really that liberal? So Brent Welder sits apart a bit. But when we sat down with all of these candidates and you asked them for policy differences, nearly every single one said, we pretty much agree on everything.
Wow. We're going to have to leave our conversation there about Tuesday's big primary elections in both Kansas and Missouri. I want to thank Colleen Nelson, a Star vice president and editor of the Star's editorial page. Stephanie Sharp, owner of the Johnson County-based Sharp Connections political firm. Thank you both for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about women committing nasty crimes. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. It's getting easier to get to work in the metro on buses or the streetcar. Yesterday, we learned how job accessibility by public transit is improving and how it can get even better. Hear about that at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday, we're back with the president of the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank. That's Esther George. She recently made news for her warning to Congress over what could slow economic growth in this country. We'll talk about that on Monday's Up to Date. Well, a new series on CBS centers on what the network says are impossible-to-believe, often absurd, true stories about the most unexpected women, PTA moms, country club chairwomen, and more, who took big risks, pocketed big cash, and then served hard time. Yes, Women in Crime. The series features insight and analysis from O.J. Simpson prosecutor and author Marcia Clark. So what was the genesis for this series? And are women really committing more crimes than ever before? I'll give you a hint, maybe not. With us, Sharon Lees is co-creator and producer of Pink Collar Crimes. That's the series we're talking about, and founder of Horizon Productions. She was last on this show in 2015 to talk about her documentary, The Gnomist. She hails from Overland Park. Sharon, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also here is Jennifer Owen. She's an assistant professor in the UMKC Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology. Jennifer, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you.
So Sharon, what inspired this series?
Well, as you know, I really love to tell stories about women. I love to tell stories about complicated women. And I'm also a fan of true crime. So
add all that up.
Yes, add it all up. Yeah. And my partner, John Kroll, my producing partner and co-creator, John Kroll in L.A., and I were talking about what can we do in the true crime space, because he also shares my passion for true crime and for telling stories about women. And we thought, well, what's different? Because there's so many shows on the air about that are true crime, and there are a lot of them are about murder, and we didn't really like murder, so we thought, well, what could we tell? And we wanted to do something with women, and we started doing our research and found that there are a lot of women who are committing these crimes that are somewhat absurd, and they are nonviolent, and don't have to do with murder, and are kind of entertaining.
How did you find them?
Well, we had a pretty good research team that whose many of the producers have done true crime before. They also have relationships with law enforcement, so we have a good pipeline there with law enforcement agencies. And Google can be your friend.
Yes, it helps, doesn't it? Yeah. How willing were they to participate, and did it take any extra prodding to get them on in front of the camera?
Well, it's a hybrid series, so there's the scripted component that's not necessarily scripted, but it's the where we do recreations. So we have actors playing them, but there's a big component of it that's documentary. And when you deal with documentary subjects, you really have to develop a relationship with people. So we, contacted people. It's not just a simple email. You have to sit down and talk with people, and they have to believe that they can trust you to tell their story accurately and that they're going to get something out of it.
Well, let me bring in Professor Owens here. I mean, Professor, this series is based on this premise that there's this growing crime wave in the country involving felonious females. Is that true? Are more women out there committing crimes these days?
The short answer is no.
Okay.
Comparatively, especially to the early 1990s, we are at some of the lowest levels of crime that we've seen in this country since we've been recording crime in the mid to early 90s.
Is that just for women or just overall?
Overall.
That's going to surprise people because crime is so much in the news these days.
It is. It's unfortunate. Every year we might have a little volatility in the data, a tiny increase, a tiny decrease. But overall, we've seen a huge decrease. I wish I could put a graph on the radio, which I know you can't do. But you will notice it fell in the hit pretty low in the 2000 and has since sort of stabilized and remained fairly low even through the recession. There are tiny ups and tiny downs. Overall, it's declined for men. It's declined for women. But what's interesting is the declines for men have been greater than the declines for women. And I say it that way because it can be misinterpreted as women's rates are going up, when realistically, whatever is causing that the great American crime decline, and there's a lot of theories behind it, have benefited men more than they've benefited women.
That's interesting. So Sharon, a little hype here when it comes to the number of women committing crimes out there?
Well, we just found tons of women who were committing these types of crimes.
They're out now, there.
They're out there. Yeah. And we were not looking at murder, which is also more men, I believe, that commit murder. So, you know, the nonviolent crimes like embezzlement and embezzlement, for one, you know, is one of those that women are committing more and more of.
And didn't I read somewhere that embezzlement is one of those crimes that's committed sort of equally in terms of numbers between men and women, Jennifer?
Yes, actually, it's one of the few crimes. Crime is disproportionately committed by men on men. And there are three exceptions to that. Women are more common or equal to that of men in the case of prostitution, which is predominantly female. In the juvenile status offense of running away from home, are more likely to have a female, in that case, quote-unquote offender.
Right.
And in the case of embezzlement, is the only sort of gender-neutral crime, meaning men and women are committing it at relatively equal rates.
And your theory behind that would be what? Because that's interesting to me.
As to why those three, or embezzlement in particular?
Embezzlement in particular.
Again, there's sort of a lot of reasons why people have postulated that particular crime. Women have access to more and more jobs, which allow them the ability to embezzle. So there was a fear that as women made their way into the workplace, they'd become more masculine in terms of offending habits. That one of the things that insulated women from committing more crime was the fact that they were stay-at-home housewives. Very hard to commit embezzlement if you don't have a job. And as women have worked their way more and more into the workforce and have access to it, you get into those situations where you need money to make ends meet. A lot of single female-headed households where a lot of economic pressure is being put on women. So I'm not exactly surprised that given the push to need financial resources that some women turn to crime, just the same reason men turn to crime.
And so the number one crime that women commit most often would be what?
Property crime.
Property crime.
Larceny theft.
Larceny theft.
Basic shoplifting, taking another person's possession. I have some data here if you're curious.
Yeah, sure.
So just to put into context overall, and this is from the Uniform Crime Report or police data that is reported to the FBI, there were just over 8.3 million arrests made in 2015. Of that—
Of women?
Overall. Men and women.
Okay.
Just under 6.1 million were men. And just over 2.2 million were female.
Oh, that's interesting.
So you can see the big disparity there. And for women, the vast majority of the time, it is for a low-level property offense. So the number one being a larceny theft, which was just over 388,000 arrests were for larceny theft. So that was sort of one of the largest component other than all other offenses, which is sort of the catch-all.
Sure.
Compare that to then what we were just talking about, which we were talking about embezzlement. And embezzlement, there were 6,154 female arrested.
Far fewer. Yeah.
Right.
Far
so fewer. Just to put it into context, and I think it's wonderful these programs that are talking to offenders, because I think offenders oftentimes are demonized. We want to celebrate the victims of homicide and we want to condemn the offenders, but it's really great to have these personalizing stories for men and women, in particular women.
What does that get us?
A better understanding that a lot of people make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And some people make mistakes which lead them to be caught. Some people make mistakes and they don't get caught.
Well, speaking of folks who make mistakes and then later regret it, I want to play a clip from the first episode of the series that just appeared, again, from Pink Collar Crimes. And this is about a mother of five who's living a middle to upper class life before she decides to rob a bank, if you can believe it. Here's the opening of the series, again, from Pink Collar Crimes.
Okay, I'm going to tell you my story. The bank was San Diego National, and it was right on the corner of where I lived. I took my kids to school like a normal mom, and on my way home, I stopped and robbed a bank. I mean, it sounds crazy to say it like that, but That's what I did. It's a series of ridiculous events. I mean, I don't know how else to say that. It's just, it's a tragic comedy is what it is.
A soccer mom who pulls off a bank heist? Believe it or not, Roxanne's about to join one of the fastest growing crime waves in America. PTA moms and society women who brazenly break the law. How could this be?
Sounds crazy, Sharon. Yes, it does. I mean, here's a mom who robs her neighborhood bank, essentially is what we're talking about here. A mother of five. How did you find this particular woman? Her name is Roxanne.
Yeah, she was pitched us from one of our research producers. And
she became the first episode in the series, yeah. So clearly you were drawn to the story.
Yeah, we were. And she had a hard time trying to, you know, decide if she wanted to tell her story. And ultimately she decided that it was a great cautionary tale. She would not be going back to prison. And, you know, she got involved. She was addicted to painkillers.
Yes.
And so that kind of, you know, fed into it. And then found herself desperate and needed money for the painkillers, then needed money because she was using all her other money to pay for the painkillers. And she was trying to hide this from her husband and trying to hide it from her family. And she actually went on to rob four banks in a period of 5 weeks.
You know, what was interesting to me about watching this particular episode is that, you know, you can relate to her. As bizarre as this sounds, this notion of her getting more and more anxious about how deeply in hock she is, and then she starts cooking the books at the office a little bit, and then the boss comes in and confronts her. I mean, you know, I've never done that before, but I can sort of understand that pressure trying to raise a family these days with all the financial pressures that parents face. And she wasn't sympathetic, but I sort of got it.
Yeah, I think that's part of what we wanted to do with the series was we wanted people to have some empathy in some cases. I mean, there are some sociopaths that you'll meet in other episodes where it's pretty rough to have some empathy for them.
Right.
But with Roxanne, I mean, we got a lot of people, a lot of tweets where people really, really felt for her, or at least understood her, mm-hmm. which, you know, like Jennifer's saying, it's good for society for us to understand what motivates people and how people can get to this point in their lives.
So she got away with it the first few times she robbed banks.
Oh, she did.
And she kept going.
And she kept going.
That just emboldened her all the more.
Yeah. And part of what, you know, we're doing with the series when we have fun is that it's, you know, it's kind of absurd. Some of them, the first robbery she did with a mask on,
yes.
and a toy gun. And then another robbery, she was on foot. And then she walked away and walked home.
She's on foot and she walks home. You're kidding me.
Yeah. And she gets inspired by seeing someone else, by being part of being a victim of a bank robbery. So it's all pretty – it's just fascinating.
Jennifer, research shows that this isn't all that uncommon, that there can often be an underlying crime that leads – to more crime. How large a factor is substance abuse among cases of female criminals? What, any sense of that?
Well, if you look at prison as a proxy and find out why people are in prison, you'll see that in a women's facility, somewhere between 25 and 30 some percent of women are there for a drug-related offense. And this is compared to, like, in a state-level prison, I think 16% of men are there for drug-related offenses. So it doesn't seem that common. But when you find out how many of them are there because of some other charge, but have a drug abuse problem, and when the prison actually goes through and tries to give counseling or treatment, you'll see upwards of 80% in some prisons, which means there is overlap. Some people turn to crime in order to be able to have the money to be able to afford. I mean, going through withdrawals, especially with the prescription drugs, is something we actually just recently studied and found a large number of women, and this is Roxanne's case, it was following childbirth. She was given a large quantity of prescription drugs, and they made her feel better in this time when there's a lot of stress and a lot of changes. And ultimately, she ran out of the pills, was going to multiple doctors, couldn't afford them, and had to buy them out of pocket. So she, while she committed a robbery and she was charged with a robbery, a lot of that was stemming from her drug use.
I was going to say, if the power of pink collar crimes is this notion that many of these victims are relatable, this notion of the opioid epidemic, certainly it can be somebody next door to you who gets hooked and didn't even intend to get hooked, right?
Yeah, and I believe that was Roxanne's case. I mean, she had no intention, it seemed, to be a drug user. But that is the case, I assume, with all drug users. I don't think anyone goes into life and goes, I can't wait to grow up and be a drug user. That sounds great.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about a new production on CBS, a new series called Pink Collar Crimes. Sharon Leese is co-creator of the series. She lives in Overland Park. She's here in the studio with me, along with Jennifer Owens, an assistant professor in the UMKC Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology. Sharon, what do these women featured in this series have in common? What did you find out?
Well, a lot of them, they have in common that they're some of them are remorseful. And so I kind of see them in more categories of having commonalities. Some of them are remorseful. There are some that we haven't even spoken to that are in prison and who don't want to talk to us. And I don't imagine that they'd be remorseful.
Right.
Like a woman who stole $9 million from her close friends and family and posed as a financial planner to them.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did she do that?
She did it. It was a pretty rudimentary system that she had. She would make statements that looked like they were from a legit financial organization, and she just took all their money. That will air on this coming Saturday, Jackpot Jackie. And she is, her sister-in-law is the one who tells us the story, and she's a victim.
Jackpot Jackie.
Yeah. So they all have different things. They're, some of them are remorseful. They've all got an element of absurdity to them.
Yeah.
Like, how did they do this? How did they get away with this? How did they get away with it for so long? And then they get caught in the most unusual ways.
Can I go back to the bank robber, Roxanne? She walked home from committing at least one of these robberies, just like did it and just strolled down the street.
Yes, and there was one of the bank employees who was so mesmerized by her that he actually followed her.
Well, how did she get away with it then?
He followed her, and then he stopped following. He followed her, and on his cell phone, he's calling the police. He's saying, I'm walking in behind her. You need to come get her.
Yeah. Well, why was CBS so interested in this series? Because it's something different, or what grabbed them, do you think?
Well, John and I met with Gen Maynard at CBS Studios, and they were really wanting to get into true crime, but they also wanted to do it with a little twist. They wanted to do it a little differently and not just do your murder fare.
Yeah. Professor, is there a profile of the typical female criminal? Do we know much about that part of this?
We know a lot about the correlates of crime and offending, things like age. The age crime curve would suggest that criminal propensity and the most amount of crime someone will commit is in the late teens, early 20s. And then over time, as people get older, they're less and less likely to offend. People who marry, there's this marriage protective factor that somehow people who are married compared to people who aren't, even at the same age and same social economic and all those background factors, something about marriage is very protective, in particular for men. So we know a lot about variations in demographic stuff that cause us to have a relative good idea of an offender. But that's not to say that they don't reach everywhere in every facet of society.
But young people, you're saying, are more prone to commit crimes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And why would that be? I guess it sort of makes sense. You're still maybe not as mature. What else might go into that?
Oh, a lot of things. So again, a whole host of theories could talk more about it than I could. But a lot of people say that you don't have those stakes in conformity yet, those bonds to society, things like a good job. I mean, you're 15. Look, there's a car that someone left running. Let's go jump on that. Have some fun. That doesn't occur to you when you're 35 and toting around two kids. You know,
yes.
There's all these things about life that start to make it so you're less and less likely or less and less willing to take that risk.
Is there a need for more research on women and crime in general, Jennifer?
Sure, yes.
I mean, are we missing key key components here that would help us navigate this better?
Yes. And in particular, what happens when we actually have now women to work with in the criminal justice system? We know that the criminal justice system is comprised mostly of men because men are more likely to be offenders. But what we found out is the system then is set up to deal mostly with men from a men's perspective. So when we get women who enter the criminal justice system, we see that they are sometimes they sometimes benefit and sometimes are penalized because of that. So prisons were set up and designed to hold men, and the programming that was offered was designed for men, and then they're like, oh, well, this should work for women, not realizing that women sometimes have unique things that need to be addressed that that prison programming wasn't set up to deal with. And so if you want women to get out of prison and be less likely to offend, looking at gender-specific programming is incredibly important.
You know, Sharon, I'm wondering, ultimately, what does this series say about women? Are you making a statement here? Is anything jumping out in particular that you wanted to emphasize?
Well, in one way, it says that women can commit crimes just as well as men can.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely that. And I do think there's a difference in the motivation with women at times. I think you can find things with women that you would not find with men.
Maybe they're just trying to help their families.
Exactly.
That kind of idea.
Like Roxanne, and then we have a PTA embezzler who embezzled $85,000 from the PTA. She was the PTA treasurer.
From the PTA?
Yeah. She just wrote checks to herself until she got caught.
Yeah.
So I think, and she was doing it for her family. She was the breadwinner for the family. She was married and had a daughter. So I do think that there are some differences, and it's really good for us to understand those.
Okay, and this series runs on which nights, Sharon?
On Saturday night at 8, 7 Central. So
7 Central on CBS. Mm-hmm. The title of the series, again, Pink Collar Crimes. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
So good to have you here again.
Thank you.
I want to thank Jennifer Owens as well, an assistant professor in the UMKC Department of Criminal Justice. Thanks for your time as well. Appreciate it. There's still time to get the latest information before Tuesday's elections. You can find all of our interviews with candidates on the issues online at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. We've got some great stuff coming up next week. State Fair Food, former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes, and oh yeah, Tuesday is primary day. Tune in for results and analysis on Wednesday. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. And finally, this is the last day for our pair of great interns, Dallas Johnson and Emily Park. We appreciate all their help this summer. I'm Steve Kraske. Have a great weekend, all. And you are up to date.